Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Last Species Standing by T.R. Harris. Narrated by Perry Daniels. Prologue. 90 ships were sent to the transit point. It wasn't a large contingent, simply because the Nurians couldn't risk more ships than that. For over 30 days, no reinforcements had come through any of the landing points, forcing Master Player Quintus Bondo, 435, to begin formulating alternative game plans. He was in contact with the survey fleet at the transit point, having laid a string of communication buoys along the way. Knowing that the forces of the CAC would locate most of the relays, he had duplicates laid along the path. The strategy worked. Once the natives found and destroyed a relay, they moved on to others along the line. All the while, the signal was simply switched to the backup relays, and communications remained intact. It was for that reason Quintus knew no transits had occurred. Now his forces waited another 3 days, the time it took the midpoint generator to recharge, on the off chance there had been some confusion as to the transit times. Yet there was no confusion. This was the 10th missed transit. Quintus didn't need any more proof that LP-6, Launch Point 6, was non-functioning. Quintus also had the intercepted news broadcasts from within the CAC to factor into his conclusion, which celebrated the return of the player, Adam Kane, and his team from the Suponic Galaxy. They were being hailed as conquering heroes, presumably for destroying or damaging LP-6. He had to agree with that assumption, although the reason he sent his forces to the predetermined transit points was to learn if the damage was slight enough to be repaired in a timely manner. Quintus was ready to concede it was not. This raised the second concern in his planning. What was to become of the remaining 800,000 Nurian players in the CAC? They were aboard the 2,000 warships Quintus had under his command, hiding within this alien galaxy, awaiting reinforcements. Yet if no reinforcements were forthcoming, what then? It was then that Quintus received the most dire news of all. Under the insistence of the third cadre players within his command, scouts were sent into the vast debris field of rock and ice that had accompanied Kane and his players back from the Suponic. It was there that conclusive evidence was attained that the debris was the remains of Nur, the birthplace of his race. That's when Quintus's plans took a sudden turn. He no longer had to devise game plans for challenges and victory against opposing CAC forces. He now had to plan for the survival of his fellow Nurians. After the initial shock faded, Quintus realized the loss of Nur was nothing more than an inconvenience. It had been centuries since the planet had served as the true home of the race. Now it was more symbolic, and only the home of the grand and qualifying masters, along with the third cadre. However, at any given time, a fair number of these officials were off-planet. They would have survived to form a new government. In addition, even the vast amount of data that ran the Empire was preserved, backed up through several redundant systems and stored on various planets throughout the Suponic. Quintus had to thank Adam Kane for his lack of knowledge of how the Empire functioned, for the minor impact this event would have in the long run. If he had targeted one of the colony planets, where billions of Nurians lived who were more critical to the daily operations of the society, then the damage would have been more widespread and lasting. As it was, the destruction of Nur was more a psychological event rather than any great setback. Also, unless Kane had managed to destroy all the launch points out to LP-6, there still remained a direct link to the midpoint between galaxies. After an appropriate time for grief and reorganization, his people would begin construction of a new gravity generator to link the two galaxies. It may be 100 years or more before such a link was re-established, yet Quintus knew they would not leave his players stranded in a faraway galaxy. All he had to do was make sure his people survived long enough for contact to be made. Quintus had already taken the first step. Suspecting the worst, he moved his fleet to the very edge of the CAC, to a region he knew to be claimed by neither the expansion nor the human Orion Cygnus Union. He located 6 planets in the area that met his requirements for gravity, atmosphere, and level of technological advancement. Each of these worlds had advanced indigenous populations, which had been integrated into the galactic community, if not into an empire. They had star travel and trade with other planets. This was important because the Nurians would need these races to provide them with sustenance, as well as industrial support. The Nurians began with strategic firebombing from orbit of select population centers, resulting in a quick subjugation of the natives. Although the compliance of the natives was a necessity, this was also a test of the resolve of the empires of the Kak. The results were encouraging. Although the conquered planets protested to the leaders of the Kak, the response came back quickly. Since none of the worlds were members of their respective empires, there would be no answer to the Nurians' aggression. Quintus helped this decision-making along by communicating to these same leaders, indicating that with their homeworld destroyed, all the Nurians wanted to do was live in peace within their new galaxy. He further stressed that the Nurians had not come to the Kak to conquer, enslave, or strip away precious resources from the natives of the Kak. Instead, they had come simply for the sport. And now that that purpose had been supplanted by the need to survive, the Nurians were no longer a threat to the galaxy. As Quintus suspected, the leaders of the Kak were desperate for peace and would sacrifice the 6 worlds to meet that goal. So the Nurians spread their forces among the conquered worlds, forcing the inhabitants to provide for their every need, including immunity challenges, yet on a much smaller scale and more pragmatic in nature. Nurian life took on an added significance, so the contests became more controlled. They were held more to retain skills and fitness rather than for societal advancement. Quintus was amused at the gullibility of the Kak leaders. They surely had the power to crush his forces and rid their galaxy of the Nurians once and for all. Yet they allowed his people to exist, even to enslave the populations of 6 worlds, just so they could claim peace in their time. And all the while, Quintus and his Nurians were simply biding time until the game resumed. Yet even as Quintus was sheltering his people from the wrath of the Kak, there were forces within his command attempting to upset his plans.
"We cannot let this go unpunished,"
exclaimed Third Cadre Master Janvis Decicus, 784. His gray face had turned several shades darker as he spoke before the assembly, anger evident in his words and countenance.
"Master Janvis, revenge is not the way of the Nurians," lead player Yonin, 984, responded.
Quintus had selected Yonin to be the voice of the leadership, tasked with presenting his side of the issue.
"We were simply overplayed by Adam Kane."
"Overplayed?" Janvis exploded. "We are talking about Nur. Its destruction was not part of a game."
"Indeed it was," countered Yonin. "Every action and reaction from the Kak has been the result of our initiating the game. And is not the Cadre's presence within the Kak the direct result of you devising a similar fate for the human homeworld of Earth, using LP-6 as the weapon?"
"You make it sound as if the destruction of Nur was my fault."
"Blame has nothing to do with it. This is how the Nurians exist. And within each game is an inherent risk. We live with this risk, or we die from it."
First lead Rad-C, 231, rose to make a statement. All Nurians were allowed to speak at these assemblies.
"I understand your feelings, Master Janvis, yet the damage to the race has been minimal. If we embark on a campaign of revenge within the Kak, we may suffer real loss to our surviving players."
"The Game Master need not be involved," Janvis said. "I will personally lead a force to track down and dispatch Kane and his mass murderers."
"Do you honestly believe the Kak will not see your actions as representative of all Nurians?" Yonin asked. "As all have said here today, we too grieve for the loss of Nur. Yet now we must think of survival first and foremost. The actions you propose would be too dangerous. Perhaps when reinforcements arrive."
By then it will be too late, Janvis growled. The lifespan of humans is even less than ours. Kane will be dead before reinforcements arrive.
Yannin looked around at the 38 other faces in the meeting room aboard the Battle Carrier 7. Some eyes met his, most averted them.
I believe both sides have made their presentations, he announced. Although the decision ultimately lies with Master Quintus, he has asked for this rare assembly to survey the feeling of his senior command. We shall now indicate a willingness to follow the game plan of Cadre Master Janvis or not. Proceed according to rank.
The vote overwhelmingly favored Quintus and his desire to stay as non-threatening to the CAC as possible. Sending a team out to kill their most famous and successful players would have only added a level of confusion and contradiction to the CAC leadership. Calls for the extermination of the Nurians would have been made, and it was uncertain which way the decision would fall. It was too great a risk for Quintus. He had to plan more long-term. There were only 100 Third Cadre within the Nurian CAC population. They'd come to the galaxy to discern the exact location of the planet Earth for a gravity attack using LP-6. Now they were without mission and purpose, other than to address the wrong Adam Kane and his players had done to the Nurians. So Quintus wasn't surprised when, a few days after the meeting, Janvis and his cadre raided the coffers of the confiscated wealth from the six worlds under Nurian control and absconded with a portion of the credits. The amount taken was insignificant when weighed against the wealth of six planets, but it would serve Janvis's purpose. Quintus knew what the Third Cadre officer had in mind. Janvis and his cadre took 17 small attack vessels and one transport, and left Nurian territory for places unknown. The word would soon go out, covering the entire galaxy. Since Nurians did not use credits, or money, as the humans called it, Quintus had only a vague idea what impact it would have on the natives of the CAC, but he knew it would be noticed. In the end, it would not be the Nurians who would kill Adam Kane and his players. It would be the natives of the CAC galaxy, what the humans called the Milky Way, who would do it for them. And the Nurian leadership would plead impotence in the actions of this breakaway group of cadre players, sparing the bulk of the population from retaliation. It was a brilliant plan, just as Janvis and Quintus had devised. Chapter 1 Riyadh Tarazi had spent most of his life looking over his shoulder, watching for people who might be watching him. By now, it was habit, and as he sat with his back against the wall at a table in Jacqueline's Tavern in the Nemourian city of Gildemont, he noticed every creature entering the bar. Jacqueline's had special meaning for Riyadh. He'd spent considerable time here during his days as leader of the Fringe Pirates. That was 20 years ago, and even though he had to believe none of his old cohorts were still around, he couldn't take the chance of being recognized. He'd shaved his thick black beard in an effort to remain anonymous, yet not to avoid law enforcement this time. Instead, it was to save him from his adoring fans. That was one side effect of saving the galaxy from deadly threats, and on more than one occasion. Sure, Riyadh wasn't as famous as his buddy Adam Kane, but he did have his following. And now that following had become a nuisance. Since returning from the Andromeda Galaxy, with a third of the planet Noor trailing behind, he and the rest of the team had been showered with praise and ceremony from one end of the galaxy to the other. This had happened before, but not to this degree. As a consequence, the team dispersed, each looking for their little piece of solitude and anonymity. Sherry and Copernicus took to a chartered sailboat and disappeared into the South Pacific, back on Earth. The aliens, Kaelor and Jim, returned to their respective homeworlds to endure whatever celebrations awaited them there, while Adam took Riyadh's lead and shot off into space in a gifted luxury space yacht for places unknown. In Riyadh's case, he sought out familiar territory, trying to recall memories from a time before he had responsibilities beyond his own selfish needs. The planet Nimor called out to him. It had been the unofficial base of the Fringe Pirates, Even Angar, his second-in-command and successor to his leadership, was a Nemorian. Now, as he scanned the room, he could imagine it was in this very spot that Adam killed a pair of Rigorian thugs the day before Riad met him, and his life changed forever. 2 decades had passed under the bridge since then, and his experience and perspective had matured over that time to take on more galactic proportions. He was now the second most famous human in the galaxy, admired, even worshipped, by an untold number of sentient beings and from thousands of different species. Not bad for a kid from the slums of Beirut, Lebanon. Riad rarely engaged in any of the illegal activities of his gang of teens and preteens. Rather, he was the mastermind, and because his capers were so successful, he drew a fervent and loyal following. His gang prospered, even in the unimaginable squalor and savagery of the city. It was his talent for leadership that first brought him to the attention of the jihadists. At 15, he was recruited into the ranks of the nascent Al-Qaeda organization. He left Lebanon for Afghanistan before being sent to Florida for advanced training in chemical engineering. Afterwards, he was given his own cell to run. Throughout the years, Riad climbed in rank, eventually becoming a legend among the freedom fighters for his cunning, attention to detail, and phenomenal success rate. Yet Riad was never a true believer. Instead, he reveled in the planning and execution of elaborate operations. It was the journey that excited him more than the destination. As a result, in his 10 years as an international terrorist, he had only personally killed 3 individuals. They had been traitors to the cause, and he felt justified in their assassinations. His operations, however, were a different matter. He felt a detachment from the death toll, taking as much responsibility for the casualties as a weapons manufacturer would for how its product was used. His product was the plan. What others did with it was of no concern to a younger, more pragmatic Riad Tarazi. Fortunately, he wasn't like that any longer. He was older, just over 50, and wiser. He saw things on a grander scale, and with the help of Adam Kane had been forced to reevaluate his place in the universe, to the point where he could see how one person could make a difference. At least, he could with a little help from his friends. His friends, at the moment, were a pair of human manufacturer reps out in the fringe hawking their wares. They noticed Riad the moment he entered the bar and glommed onto him immediately. It was rare to find another human on Nimor these days. They didn't recognize him, so he introduced himself as an indie merchant, just passing through the fringe. The intoxicants flowed, and Riad began to relax, lost within his artificial persona. That's when he noticed the 2 Rigorians enter the bar. To Riad, they stood out immediately, more so than normal. First of all, they paused to scan the other patrons within the dimly lit room. This was unusual. Rigorians didn't give a damn who was around. They'd dominate the scene wherever they went. But these 2 were looking for something, or someone. Secondly, when their eyes fell upon Riad and the trio of humans, there was only the slightest hesitation before they averted their eyes. This was the final tell. Humans were the apex predator in the galaxy, and a definite challenge to the huge lizard-like beasts. As it was in the animal world, they would have made eye contact, if for no other reason than to acknowledge the presence of another killer in the room. But these savage creatures tried too hard to look unconcerned, and when they took seats at the bar with a clear view of the humans, the hair on the back of Riad's neck stood up. They weren't here looking for his autograph. They had a more sinister purpose in mind. Never one to let a bad situation come to him, Riad lifted the glass of half-full intoxicant and placed it to his lips. He threw back his head and guzzled a large amount before spitting it back into the glass. Then he turned to his new friends.
I regret to say this, but I have to drain the lizard.
The 2 men overreacted, buoyed by the quantity of alien alcohol in their systems.
Good luck with that, one of them said. I nearly puked when I went in there a while back. Now I'd rather go outside and piss on the sidewalk than go back in there.
Riyadh knew what he meant. Alien bathrooms of the public variety were a human's worst nightmare. First of all, they were unisex, whatever that meant in an alien society where it was often hard to tell one sex from the other. They also had every imaginable accoutrement, from raised toilets and urine troughs to simple holes cut in the floor. The stench was indescribable, as a plethora of digestive systems did their thing, while producing a cocktail mix of paint-peeling gases and cast-off fluids. Riyadh left the table and staggered to the restroom, playing up his drunken state even more so for his surreptitious audience. Fighting back a gag, he moved to the back of the room and stood before a disgusting metal bowl covered in yellowish-green grime. A moment later, the two Rigorians entered. One of the 7-foot-tall lizards stationed himself by the door, while the other moved in behind Riyadh.
"Tarazi! Riyadh!" the alien called out.
Riyadh glanced over his shoulder.
"Yeah, that's me," he said proudly. "I didn't think anyone would recognize me. Wait a minute and I'll give you an autograph." "Autograph? What is that?"
asked the Rigorian with a growl.
"A memento. Something you can show your friends and family that you actually met me."
Rigorians didn't seek autographs, nor did they engage in hero worship.
"We are not here seeking such things," the alien bellowed.
"I was afraid you were going to say that."
Riyadh glanced off to his left. The lizard by the door was drawing his MK-17. With his arm still pointed toward his crotch, Riyadh activated the small laser weapon he held in his hand. It was battery-powered and good for a limited range and a 2-second beam. But that was long enough for the red light to appear on the wall next to the alien's head by the door, momentarily distracting him. As his head turned, Riyadh shifted the angle slightly, sending the 1,000-degree beam slicing effortlessly through the Rigorian's neck. The alien behind him also had his weapon drawn, yet even if he pressed the trigger, Riyadh would be upon him before the targeting computer could lock on. With the laser weapon now just an inert 6-inch metal tube, Riyadh clinched it in his hand and spun, placing a solid right fist against the side of the Rigorian's long head. The alligator-like creature crumbled to the grimy, smelly floor. Riyadh placed his booted left foot on the alien's gun hand, while dropping his right knee onto the bulbous chest of his assailant. He had his own MK-17 drawn and pressed against the side of the alien's head. Just then, the door to the bathroom opened. Both alien and human looked toward the portal. A 4-eyed thing with crusty gray skin stood in the doorway. A pair of eyes locked to the decapitated Rigorian on his left as the other pair took in Riyadh sitting atop the other huge lizard, gun to his head. The gray alien took a step back and closed the door. Riyadh turned his attention back to the Rigorian.
"What the hell?" he said. "Why are you after me, my friend?" "Friend," said the alien, confused.
The universal translation bug implanted behind the alien's ear indicated Riyadh had warm feelings for him, even as the other part of the sentence knew him to be a threat.
"Just tell me why you're looking for me." "It is for the bounty." "What bounty?"
When the alien hesitated, Riyadh pressed the barrel of the MK harder against his skin.
"You know who I am. Don't test me." "The Nurian bounty."
Riyadh was taken aback.
"Why would the Nurians have a bounty out on me? And for that matter, why would you do anything the Nurians want you to do? They're a threat to everyone in the galaxy." "We do it exclusively for the credits." "Yeah, I figured that. But why are the Nurians after me?" "As I understand, they found evidence that you destroyed their homeworld of Nur. They have now placed a galaxy-wide offer for the death of you and your team." "How will they pay for it?" "They may be limited in number and without reinforcement, but they do have footholds on 6 worlds. They've confiscated all the wealth thereon, which is more than enough to satisfy my needs."
Riyadh's mind was racing. The entire team was in danger, and with a king's fortune offered for their heads. As pragmatic as most creatures are, there could already be an army of hired killers after them. He had to let the others know.
"Thanks for the information," he said, flashing his trademark brilliant white smile at the Rigorian.
In normal circumstances, this would have signaled a death challenge, but Riyadh figured he and his alien buddy were beyond that. So he simply triggered his MK and splattered the Rigorian's brain matter across the already filthy floor. He figured no one would notice. Chapter 2 From 70 feet in the air, the pair of massive hammerhead horses didn't look that imposing. Unfortunately, Adam Kane also knew that was an illusion. Hammerheads, that's what he called them, and for good reason. The magnificent beasts were easily 2 tons in weight, with rippling muscles under a shiny coat of black hair. They had exceedingly thick necks, required to hold up the knobby, triangle-shaped plates of bone resting on their foreheads, wide at the top and tapering to a point near their long snouts. A pair of large black eyes extended on nubs at each end of the wide top, hence the hammerhead shark comparison. Underneath the plate was a normal-looking, horse-like snout and long mouth, with a row of rounded teeth used for grazing. The beasts also had a set of long, muscular arms extending from the torso, along with a pair of 6-fingered hands, 3 nimble digits on each side of the wide palm. Just a pair of average 10-foot-tall centaurs, except for the plates of bone on their heads, and along with the fact that these 2 huge creatures were trying to kill him. The planet was designated ES-341 and was a heavy gravity world, by comparison, which made it less attractive for colonization by the mostly lightweight members of the Expansion or the Orion Cygnus Union. Yet it was just right for Adam. He'd come to the planet looking for respite from the constant ceremony and celebration that resulted from his most recent saving of the Milky Way galaxy, this time from the Nurian menace. Here there were no admiring indigenous species to contend with, and he wouldn't have to worry about losing bone and muscle mass as he would on a low-gravity world. In reality, that wasn't much of a concern anymore, not with the tiny tumor of immortal alien mutant cells residing within his skull, which were capable of altering his physical condition. That was another reason he sought the solitude of ES-341. He needed to learn more about his abilities and how to utilize them. As he'd experienced over the past 6 months, control of his abilities wasn't the issue. How to summon them on demand was. It was one thing to have a surge of strength and energy, but not knowing if it would come when needed, and to what degree, was a bummer. Having that knowledge would come in handy as he planned his day. So ES-341 was the perfect place to hang out for a while, away from the crowds of well-wishers and clingers-on, who just wanted to bask within the glow that was Adam Kane. He could also experiment with his superhuman abilities without people knowing he had them. As soon as he landed the small personal space yacht, which was itself a gift from a grateful earthbound trillionaire, he began to hear strange claps of thunder echoing through the towering peaks of the surrounding mountain range. It was springtime on ES-341, with a lingering of snow on the higher elevations. Otherwise, the place was a study in all the possible shades of green, in the trees, in the grasses, and even the glowing aurora in the evening sky. Each time he'd hear the booms, he'd look into a clear blue sky expecting thunderclouds, but there were none. Then, 2 days later, with his curiosity piqued and a theory in mind, Adam set off through the pine forest looking for the source of the explosions. He emerged from the tree line on the edge of a wide meadow of waving green grass, which terminated at a steep cliff falling off into a river valley far below. As he suspected, he came upon the huge horses, each sporting the crusty head plate and with eyes spaced 3 feet apart along the edges. Adam watched in amazement as the huge beasts squared off, then charged at incredible speed toward one another,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?